Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Cindy DeFerdinand, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the Concierge Coaches Show. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Cindy DeFerdinand.
Hi, everybody.
And today is our part two episode, the long-awaited part two episode, with Brian Cuban as our special guest. He is going to talk about recovery and continue to talk about his latest publication and book, The Addicted Lawyer. Welcome back to the show, Brian.
It's good to be back. Thank you so much for having me on again.
We're thrilled to have you again. I really enjoyed last week. And last week, we got to hear your whole story, and it was so heartfelt. I just want to thank you again for telling your story. And I think at the end of the show, we kind of landed at the end with you getting sober. And I know that you have been sober for a decade now.
Yes, I had 10 years, April 8th.
10 years, April 8th.
Yeah, and my wife, to celebrate, got me tickets to Billy Joel in New York City, one of my favorite singers, so that was a nice way to celebrate.
Fabulous. I've seen him. He's really great. Did you enjoy it?
I'm a huge Billy Joel fan. I played the piano for many years. I play a lot of his songs. And back in the day when it was safe, growing up in Pittsburgh, I used to hitchhike to different cities on the East Coast to see him in concert.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, he's really good. He puts on a good show. Pittsburgh. Yeah. So why don't we start with as you've moved forward into, a new paradigm into sobriety and recovery. Bruce and I were talking a little bit before the show about coaching, sober coaching, recovery coaching. And, obviously we're both coaches, and we were curious as to if you have had any experience with coaching personally, or, what your perception or maybe knowledge of coaching, the coaching profession is. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, I know what sober coaching is. I know there are certifications for it. I coach people all the time. I just don't get paid for it.
It's not what you do for a living.
That's not what I do for a living. That's right. I mean, I fully support anyone who is helping somebody find recovery.
That's
whatever
nice.
Means that is. There are different ways people can go. There's 12-step. There's sober coaching. There's sober coaching in conjunction with 12-step.
There's therapy.
There's standard therapy. We have all these different options. And in the face of an overwhelming epidemic in the opioid area where people are dying, especially in the East, every day. I read a stat that within the last 2 years, more people have died from opioid overdoses than died in the Vietnam War. It was something like that.
Oh, my goodness.
But, I mean, you put it in context, or it's something to put it in some shocking context, and I didn't need the context to know we are having a problem, a major problem, because I live it every day talking to people. But there can never be too many arrow in the quiver, whatever that saying is. There can never be too many arrows, to help somebody get sober.
Right, to solve it.
Coach.
Yeah, to just for people to, acknowledge, recognize, shift their perception, get the help they need, and be able to build a life. And, it's interesting, like on the coaching side of it, I know, Bruce and I started the show, and maybe we're reiterating a little bit for the point of working with you on the show today, Brian, but we started the show to sort of broadcast what coaching is and what a support it can be to people, and bring coaches from all different walks of life, working with all different types of people, and really introduce what coaching is and isn't, so that the audience can have a better understanding of how it can support and help. And recently I had an interaction where somebody heard me talking and they said, you know what, I'd like to get that contact and, you know, certain type of coaching. And then later they said, well, you know, I really thought about it. I have so many coaches. And I thought they meant they were working with several coaches professionally. But what they meant was they thought everybody who helped them in their life was a coach. And so I think it is important. Bruce, I know you agree with me. It's why we did the show, is to really broadcast to everybody what coaching is, and that it is a modality. It is a skill set you have to be trained to do. And there's many levels of certification, and it can be a great support to people in many areas of their life, and as well as in the recovery process. Go ahead, Bruce.
Right. So, yeah. But the thing of it is that people, you know, and having Brian, and I've known Brian for years and his friend, and, you know, I want, you know, I like Brian to, you know, have him on the show helps people approach whatever methodology they need to get the help they need. And hearing Brian, right, you know, and his story will, I think, and it has inspired many, many people. His first book, Shattered Image, inspired many, many people. As Brian, you indicated last week, you know, men would come up to you and say, God, I thought I was the only one, and those things. And
right.
So what, you know, Brian is, I think, is a real catalyst. I think he's a catalyst to then inspire people to get the help that they need. Some people might go to a 12-step program. Some people might go to a more relapse prevention, behaviorally based program. Some people might not go to treatment at all. You know, I'm getting more referrals every month for people who just refuse to go to these kind of cookie cutter treatment programs and want a specialty, you know, sober coaching / recovery coach thing where there's accountability, drug testing, and we kind of, you know, march through some of the things that treatment centers do, but it doesn't take place in a treatment center. So, you know, and like Brian said, you know, as long as we're here to help people get the help that they need, and there's various ways to get that help. And that's one of the things I love about Brian is that he's, you know, he's a good thinker and he's very open-minded. So,
Flexible.
Is that right, Brian? Is that right?
Well, I do think that in the area, I will interject here. I do think that in the area, so there is an area where we need to be careful, and this doesn't apply to you two because you have done the work. You are constantly trying to learn. You have your certifications. Okay. But I see a lot of people where, okay, I'm in recovery, so now I'm a sober coach.
Right.
Knowing your own story doesn't make you an expert in recovery.
Right.
Doesn't qualify you to advise other people on certain issues. So I do think we have to be careful with that, where just people who they have a certain level of recovery and just hang out a shingle. I think you do have to get the certifications. You do have to do the work.
That the credibility is important. That's what you're pointing out. People to get help, but you want it to be credible help.
Well, I think when you part of the getting credible help are people who are constantly expanding their knowledge base beyond their own personal experience. And getting certifications and stuff requires you to do that.
Well, that's very well said, because beyond your personal experience is the push point for you.
That's right. My personal experience empowers me to talk to people about my personal experience.
Right.
I never talk. I always talk in the first person. Here's what I did. Here's what helped me. I never talk in the you. Okay. Here's what you should do. If it's not something, you know, I haven't done, I am not qualified to be a sober coach because I have not gone out and done the work necessary to, you know, to do that. And I think one of the things I see, not all the time, but are people who, you know, they have recovery. Okay. I'm a sober coach. And that kind of bothers me a little bit, but for those who go out and do the work, get the certification, expand their knowledge base, I think it's great.
Well,
we appreciate that.
And Brian, you know, I've talked to you before, and we've had discussions, and where I've tried to broach the subject with you about, hey, you know, how did you feel about possibly getting your own certification and becoming a coach? And like, you're pretty clear about what you want to do. You want to stick with public speaking and being an author. You know,
yeah, that's just not who I am. I mean, within the 12-step community, and anyone who comes to me, phone, email, you know, whatever, I will give them the benefit of my personal experience. And that's what I'm comfortable doing.
That's awesome. That, but that's laser focused. It's just say you're just
right. That is not
stepping into what you want to do. You're focused on what you want to do and what you don't want to do, which is a great place to be in life, right?
That's right. And that's the zone that I enjoy, and that's the zone I'm comfortable in. If you were asking me, I don't foresee myself going out and getting certifications and this and that, because it's not, I enjoy telling my story. I think telling my story helps people. I like helping people that way.
Right. And you're very good at it, by the way. I was just so caught up in your story last week that I didn't even let Bruce ask a question, right?
He was in the middle of the longest petty mall seizure known to man.
yeah, I was just caught up, man. So you definitely do a good job telling your story, right? So, and that's
thank
great.
You. And that's what I'm passionate about. And that's what I enjoy. That's so as long as that's what I enjoy and that's what I'm passionate about, that's what I will keep doing. My brother Mark has a saying, don't follow your passion, follow your efforts. My response to that, and I understand where he's coming from, but my response to that is, it's always nice when your passion and your effort are one and the same, right?
Yeah, it makes it easier to do, right?
Exactly.
That's right.
Brian, I was kind of curious. We've talked about recovery advocacy and being a recovery advocate. What are some of the things you've been doing in that area?
I speak quite a bit. I speak at local events. I speak at national events. I speak at nonprofit events. I speak at colleges. So I do a lot of sharing of my story. I talk to people every day who email me about recovery. So that's really what I do. Obviously, I'm waiting for my second book to come out about addiction in the legal profession. So that'll be out in June. So those are the things I'm doing. I'm already have my third book in mind, which is tentatively entitled Name Fame, which will be how siblings of ultra famous people deal with celebrity. And so
cool.
That is because it was something that I dealt with, and it's something I get asked about a lot. People always ask me, how did Mark's celebrity affect your journey through addiction and recovery? Well, the first thing I tell them is that I was having issues before Mark became famous. So you can't say that triggered any of it, right?
Right, exactly.
And, my journey through that, nothing I went through was Mark's fault or anyone in my family's fault.
Of course. Yeah, you take responsibility.
Absolutely. Yeah. Recovery is accountability, and I have to be accountable
right.
for the things I did. So, but I can say that I certainly took advantage of that during a period of my life when people were coming up to me and putting cocaine in my pocket. I was getting into, I could walk into any nightclub in Dallas, and breach the lines, all night parties and this and that. I certainly took advantage of that. And it became easier for me to be Mark Cuban's brother than have my own identity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes
and because sense. I didn't have my own identity, I didn't know who Brian Cuban was. I was ashamed of the Brian Cuban I knew. It became easier to just be that because that gave me the validation I was seeking, that I had been seeking since I was a child. And that led to cocaine, relationships with girls half my age were based solely on cocaine and this and that. Anything that would give me validation that I was worthy, that I was loved. And that was just surviving. That was not a life.
Right.
And so the celebrity affected me in that way. That's not Mark's fault. That was my fault. I needed to figure out who Brian Cuban was and have my own identity. And it took a long time. I'm still in therapy.
But you've come a long way.
And part of figuring that out was obviously getting sober.
Right.
You can't figure out who you are while you're high all the time.
Yeah, distorted perceptions, right?
And that was one of the it was a distorted perception, and that was when I first did cocaine, my first line of cocaine. That's what I wanted. I wanted to embrace that distorted perception of this person that the high gave me that I wanted to live, and so I became comfortable with that distorted perception as a means of surviving day to day. And I had to get past that. I had to break it all down to ground zero and realize that the real Brian Cuban is a very shy, very reserved person, and that's okay.
Right.
Instead of trying to be something I'm not.
Exactly. Good for you.
And not to be cliche, but is that, you know, you hear about self-medicating. Well, I'm just self-medicating and this and that. I mean, would you use that term, or is it something different or deeper? Or what
no,
is your sense
I was I was absolutely self-medicating. I was self-medicating that I couldn't to get a feeling I couldn't get to face life on its own terms,
mm-hmm.
and to mute the feelings of shame I felt about myself. So it's absolutely
exactly.
self-medication.
Right. And then at what point, you know, and you hear the sayings, right? I was sick and tired of being sick and tired and those things. I mean, you know, coming to the end of yourself, kind of talk a little bit about some of the, you know, the mental processes where you said, okay, this is, and I remember you talked to me about your various rehab stints and people with, you know, Mark would pay for this and that, but I've never been to residential treatment.
So let's okay. be careful there, because I've never been to residential treatment. I got sober in 12-step.
Okay, that's right. It was another,
I got sober in 12-step and therapy, and private therapy.
Okay. Okay.
So, but there were countless morning after regret relapses. You know, I won't do coke again. I won't drink again. But of course, once the consequences get far enough in the rearview mirror, and the feeling
right,
of shame and guilt get far enough in the rearview mirror, it's back to ground. You know, you're ready to rock and roll again. So there were countless relapses of that nature. Mark threatened. I was working for Mark, and he threatened to fire me if I didn't get sober. And so, yeah, there were certainly moments. My first trip to the psychiatric facility after my near suicide attempt was a strong moment, but it wasn't a moment that moved me into recovery. That was about 14 or 15 months before I actually moved into recovery. And then there was the standing, and then there was the second trip after a 2-day blackout, which I went back to the same facility and standing in that parking lot. And that's really when I realized that this was it. And that was April 7, 2007. And that's when I realized that this was it, standing in that parking lot of Green Oak Psychiatric Hospital in Dallas,
yeah.
that one, there wouldn't be a third trip because I'd be dead.
Right.
Two,
right.
I realized that my family had finally had enough. That gray area that every family struggles with between love enablement and recovery
right.
had finally become
tough
clear
one.
To my family. And my younger brother had even said to me, if you ever do cocaine again, we're done. And I realized that I was about to lose my family. And I don't know if I talked about this in our last episode, but I thought about my father. And I thought about what he used to say to us growing up. He would say, Mark, Jeff, Brian, or Brian, Jeff, Mark. When you have siblings, you know, the dad always gets the name wrong. And he would say, and he would joke, he'd be tongue-in-cheek, and he'd say, girlfriends may come and go. Wives may come and go. Well, for me, they certainly have. I've been married 3 times. But he'd say, but when push comes to shove, all you have is each other. And he would say to us, no matter where you go in life, no matter where your travels take you, no matter what you're going through, you pick up that phone and you call the other brother and you tell that brother you love him. And you ask your brother what you can do for him. My father was the middle of 3 children, 3 boys, just like me. He was the middle of 3 boys. He understood that bond. My father had a car trim shop. They put on convertible tops and stuff like that in Pittsburgh with his older brother, Marty, from the end of the Korean War until his older brother passed away in 1999. My father understood that bond of brothers, that bond of family. And that was a gift he passed down to us. And standing in that parking lot.
It's a great story.
I realized that I was about to lose that gift. And if you want to know how that gift has stuck and what that gift meant, all these decades later, 1,200 miles away, my father, Mark, Jeff, and I all live walking distance from each other.
That's
awesome. Not an accident. That is the gift of family, the gift of brothers that my father handed down to us. That was it. I wasn't ready to lose that. And that was my quote-unquote aha moment.
Wow.
It wasn't
That's a
about
great
sick
story.
And tired of being sick and tired. It was about I didn't want to lose my family.
Right. Family's so important. So important.
Yes. And I'm very lucky because I had that closeness. A lot of people don't have that, and it's not part of the recovery. For a lot of people, the dysfunction is part of their ongoing issues. Right. But for me,
but you, yeah. I was going to say, thank God you had that.
The closeness was something I needed. And I'll tell you how that extended even further. I guess it was about 3 days after I walked in the 12-step, and my girlfriend, now my fiance, my wife had moved out after the blackout. I walked over to my father's house, literally lived right across the street from me, and he still does. I walked over there, I opened the door, and he knew nothing about this. He was the one person I wanted to shield from all this. He knew nothing about any of my issues. So I sit down and talk with him, and I started crying, and his response to me was, "Brian, I love you. Move in with me. We'll get through this together."
He was with you.
He was with me. He was,
what a gift. What a gift.
That, right? Yes. And so that is when I began my recovery, because that was April 8th, a couple days before that is when I walked into 12-step and picked up my desire chip.
Did you move in with him?
I did move in with him. I lived with him for about 2 weeks and allowed me to, you know, stabilize myself while I was in 12-step. And I started hitting, you know, did the 90 and 90, hitting all the meetings. And it wasn't just 12-step. I was also in therapy with a psychiatrist for a couple years. I'd been in therapy for a couple years, but I had been lying to him. I had been not honest with him about what I was going through. I had been going to him to get my antidepressants. I had one of the few psychiatrists in Dallas that also did therapy. Usually you have to go to a psychologist and the psychiatrist just prescribes medication. But my guy happened to also did therapy, a dying breed. But
right.
I wasn't honest with him. And people always ask me, why wouldn't you be honest with your psychiatrist? You're paying the guy some ungodly amount. Well, shame knows no hourly rate, right? When you're ashamed and you're not ready, you're not ready. I hear from people all the time, I haven't told my psychiatrist this, I haven't told my psychologist this or that. Well, why not? I'm ashamed. I don't want to tell them. I'll be embarrassed.
What would you say to somebody out there that isn't even going to get that help, that psychiatrist or psychologist, that their shame is holding them back from even getting the help? That it's just going to take what it takes, and the time will come when they're ready.
I would say that no matter how alone you feel, you're not alone. And no matter how many times I say that, it's not going to cause someone to say, you know, oh, I'm not alone. Okay, thank you. That makes me feel a whole lot better. But what I do hear is, I have no one I can tell. There's no one that loves me. There's no one I can tell. There's no one I feel, you know, there's no one who can open up. And what I do a lot of times, I say, let's forget about who you think loves you. Who do you care about? Give me a list of 10 people you care about.
That's a good
one. Let's go through that list and let's talk about whether we can open up to each of them and how we can open up and what we can do. The majority of time I can get someone to start a conversation with somebody.
That's cool. That's cool, because that's what it takes, that opening up.
And that's right. And the opening up is generally the first step. You have to tell somebody.
Wow, that's powerful. And a lot of people just aren't able to for a very, very, very long time. So you were at least seeking professional help, even if you weren't being honest with them.
That's right. I had been seeking professional help for clinical depression, which is totally, you know, I mean, which is unrelated to my to the addiction and getting sober. If anything, I mean, you know, the addiction made it worse because alcohol counteracts antidepressants, right?
Right, right.
So I wasn't getting the effect of my antidepressants because I'm drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scary because having to face clinical depression on its own terms is not a pleasant thought. It's hard enough. And I totally get that people are afraid of that. But I couldn't move forward until I faced that clinical depression on its own terms. And getting sober isn't always, you know, getting sober is important. For me, I break it down into two steps, and I'm not sure if we talked about this last time. There was figuring out dealing with where I was, which is getting sober, and there was dealing with how I got there, which is dealing with the clinical depression, dealing with childhood issues. If I could get sober, but if I didn't deal with those other issues, I was always, for me personally, I was always going to be vulnerable to relapse. When something triggered, something going back to childhood. So for me to have a solid recovery, for me personally, it was important to tear back those layers in my life and deal with how I got there.
Mm-hmm.
So that has been part of my ongoing recovery as well, and it's still part of my ongoing recovery.
Exactly. So like you were saying, there's the old program saying about you're only as sick as your secrets or what you don't tell, you know, what you're sitting on, and to be able to get that out is great. So, and you know, like I said, hearing your story, it's so great that the relationship with your family was a beacon that was just stronger than the addiction. You know what I mean? You had that thought that, you know what, I'm about to lose my family. And it sounds like that was a huge contributor for you to make the decision.
The fear of losing that was stronger than my shame, which was
which
was needed for me to move forward. Shame will drag you down. Shame will keep people out of recovery. Shame is brutal.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you know, and for me, my shame was on so many different levels that it was something that was driving me in addiction from day to day, from minute to minute, from second to second. And to find that one moment, in that one moment in time when my desire, you know, to have family was stronger than my shame was key. Because you know, who knows when these moments happen again, and if you're going to act on it when that moment happens.
Yeah, and then that's so necessary, that moment, right?
That's right, because we could look back to 2005 when I was putting a 45 automatic in my mouth. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to trigger anyone here. I probably shouldn't have said that. But if you have any listeners, you know, I made it through that. And I was suicidal. And I went to a psychiatric facility. That was not stronger than my shame. So it comes to the right, it has the right moment in time.
And you can't make that happen for someone. Yeah.
No, you can't. You can't. Mm-hmm. It has to come together. It comes together differently for every person.
Wow. Well, I'm glad
I'll follow that up in saying what sober coaching does is increases the opportunity to be there at that moment.
Right.
So when someone has a sober coach or a 12-step, whatever, the more connections you have, the more sober connections you create, the more coaching connections you create, the more healthy connections you create, the more opportunities there are for someone who can help to be there when that moment happens.
Excellent.
That's
absolutely
very well
right.
said. Very well said.
Yes, yes. Well, I want to talk a little bit before the time gets away about your book, The Addicted Lawyer. And I think
About Shattered Image? Should we talk a little bit about that first? Or?
Sure. Shattered Image was my first book. Shattered Image was written primarily, as a lot of self-help memoirs start out, as therapy for me.
Good.
I was struggling to figure out my disorder, which is body dysmorphic disorder. If people don't know what it is, it's when you take a small or even non-existent defect in your body and exaggerate it to the point where it affects your ability to function, quote-unquote, normally in life. I was dealing with this overpowering, delusional feeling that I had this huge stomach, and it related back to fat shaming and, you know, all bullying, all kinds of things came together to cause this disorder. And it's not a disorder that's very well understood. It's been around for 100 years. But it's only been studied in earnest for, say, the past two decades. So I was trying to come to terms with that because it was driving a lot of my other issues, the eating disorders, the drug use.
Bulimia,
I had no the bulimia. I have no history of addiction in my family. This was all of these destructive behaviors were spinning around body dysmorphic disorder.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So my book was written to try to come to terms with that and to allow others to show that there is hope for recovering from body dysmorphic disorder, because it's a very difficult disorder to recover from. Very difficult. There are very few people who understand it. There are very few people who treat it. one of the major people in, she's out of Brown University, Dr. Catherine Phillips is one of the major people, but there aren't a lot of them who treat it and who understand it. A lot of people say they treat it, but they understand the therapies underlying it, but not as much the disorder.
Not the disorder, yeah, which you really need experience with.
So that's right, You know, cognitive behavioral therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, they understand the therapies that treat BDD, body dysmorphic disorder, but maybe not as much as the, you know, the disorder itself. So finding someone who treats the disorder itself as the whole package is a lot more difficult, but there are people. So I wanted to write Shattered Image to let people know that recovery is possible from that, because it has a strong correlation with suicide. It has a strong correlation with depression, with drug addiction, with eating disorders, with steroid addiction, with steroid abuse, with plastic surgery abuse. There are a lot of destructive behaviors that correlate with body dysmorphic disorder. So I felt it was very important to reach out to that demographic and let them know that recovery is possible.
That's wonderful. And since you wrote that book, do you think that it's improving? Do you think the awareness is improving, that more people are getting help, there's more people that can help and understand the disorder?
I think there is. And I only know that anecdotally, because the number of people that reach out to me, so I'm not aware of any study that says there is a greater awareness of body dysmorphic disorder. It's, you know, there are, unfortunately, it's not something that is considered prime time, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah.
In the world of psychiatric issues. But there's, you know, I get contacted all the time by men and women who are struggling with it. And I do my best. I'm not a doctor, but I'll refer them to people who deal with it. I'll refer
That's
them
wonderful.
To the books. You know, there are some great books out there, The Broken Mirror by Dr. Catherine Phillips. So the first step I try to work them through is understanding what they're going through, like I had to do. And then try to hook them up with people who actually treat the disorder. It
right,
affects 2-3% of the population, men and women equally. I mean, it's an issue.
That's good that you have those statistics right there for us, too. That's so helpful. So equally men and women.
So, yeah, that's why I wrote part. And Shattered Image is as much about body image and eating disorders and such as it is about addiction. I don't address addiction to the extent I do in The Addicted Lawyer, my second book, which is almost primarily about dealing with addiction, alcohol and drugs. And primarily within the legal profession, but it has universal application, because lawyers are people too, right?
Exactly.
And so in the book, I talk about there are stories from people who have dealt with heroin, alcohol, cocaine, my story. So unlike Shattered Image, which is just my story, The Addicted Lawyer has stories from other people, law students and lawyers, who have dealt with addiction from many different aspects.
Sounds fabulous.
Yeah, so while the book is about addiction within the legal profession and law school, I think anyone could read it and relate to it.
Anybody who's struggling with addiction.
Anyone who's struggling can read and relate to it.
Okay, and that's going to be out in June?
That'll be out June. It is released June 13th. June 13th is its release date.
Okay, cool.
Yes, but it is available.
Good to know.
It is available right now for pre-order on Amazon, and I'm happy to say that in pre-order it became an Amazon bestseller, so there is clearly a lot of interest in the topic.
I bet there is, yeah, and we will help spread the word so people can read it. Not just lawyers, but I'm sure a lot of attorneys that have struggled with this will be happy to see a book out about it, you know what I mean, so they can relate
sure.
to it.
And law students, and anyone who's struggling or anyone who knows someone who's struggling. Because, well, the professions change, but the basics stay the same, don't they? Powder to nose, bottle to mouth, injecting heroin, that is all the same regardless of where you come from.
Right, and what profession you're in.
It is the same. And I was wondering, is there something about the legal area that attracts substance abuse? In your book, do you talk about some of the things that are some of the unique stressors maybe that lawyers or others have?
I do. Mm-hmm. Lawyers, we're in a profession that tends to attract quote-unquote type A personalities, competitive personalities. And so when you have that kind of personality and where you're in a profession that has a culture of drinking, you know, that starts in law school, you may be less likely to seek help. You may be less likely to tell someone. Lawyers are taught starting in law school, not taught in the course way, but taught in terms of culturally and in the competitive nature of what we do, that showing weakness, showing vulnerability is weakness. And when you combine that with the societal stigma of addiction, that you know, addiction is a choice, addiction is weakness, which we know is false, that then you tend to have more people who just don't want to seek help. And we get to the point where one in three lawyers who answered a survey that was done back in a groundbreaking survey done by that Betty Ford Hazelton Foundation and the American Bar Association, shows that one in three lawyers is a problem drinker.
Wow, that's high.
And there is we have a culture of drinking. We have a culture of fear in terms of getting help because our profession depends on our license, right?
Keeping And coming out, I mean, the risk of losing your license is probably what keeps a lot of people in secret too, right?
Well, the fear, there isn't always that risk, but there's a perception of risk. Okay, there's a culture of fear. There's a culture of fear of losing clients, fear of losing your job, fear of being unable to maintain a certain lifestyle, which tells lawyers that, okay, I'm not going to seek help. We are a profession of thinkers. I can think my way through this, right? What does that really mean? I can manipulate my way through this. And one of the hardest problems I have in talking with lawyers is getting them to the place of realizing that dealing with this now, regardless of whatever the consequences are, is a lot better than waiting till it blows up in your face when the consequences are exponentially worse.
Mm-hmm.
Pushing it off rarely leads to a good result.
And do you find it that this field, they tend to push it off more, keep pushing it back?
Absolutely, because we think we can. We believe we can think our way through it. We can work our way around it. We can figure out a way out of it. And one of the biggest problems within the legal profession is to saying, you know what, I need help. Lawyers don't want to do that as a group.
That's tough.
And they have a fear. They have a fear of the lack of. They have a fear that whatever they say is going to get out. When in fact, there are organizations like legal assistance programs. We have at law firms. They have employee assistance programs. These things are protected by statute. They're confidential. But there is this culture of fear in the profession that if I tell someone, it's going to get out. It's going to get to the state bar. It's going to get to this person. It's going to get to that person. When in reality, the only way it's going to get out is if you tell someone.
Right. Do you think that lawyers also, as they kind of work through the contemplation stage and getting help, do you think there's something about the way they think? You know, you talked about kind of high ego or, you know, kind of a more aggressive personality. Do you think also for them the type A, if you will, the point for these folks to get to the point where they're willing to seek help, do you think that's going to have to be a in your experience, is that more of an aggressive man? There was more on the line for them, or they really were up against the wall before they changed, or
I think it just depends on the person.
Yeah.
Depends on the person. Every story is going to be different. Every journey is going to be different. I have spoken to lawyers who have immediately indicated a willingness to, you know, get with the lawyer assistance program, which is very important. Every state has one. And they're there to help lawyers who are in trouble. And they, in most states or many states, they help law students as well.
That's good.
So there are options. And within a law firm or within a lot of companies, forget law firms, you have your own employee assistance program, right? I'm not aware of any state where it, you know, where an employer can ask why you're taking medical leave. They can't ask that.
Right.
So
good information.
You'd have to check your own state, but I think that's the law pretty much in every state where an employer can't ask if you're taking medical leave. I mean, ask why you're taking medical leave, but to get people to that point where they believe it's not going to get out is hard.
Yeah. There's the shame again and the fear.
The shame and the fear. And there is a culture of fear in the legal profession of getting help.
You know, yeah. And there's always a reason. I can't, hey, I got too many cases. I can't shuffle my cases to another partner or another staff attorney.
That's funny.
It's very hard.
It's funny you bring that up. I don't know if I talked about this the last time. I remember when I finally got honest with my psychiatrist, and you know, 10 years ago, and we were talking about residential treatment, and I refused to go. And my response to him is, you know, I have a case. I have one case left. I'm a busy lawyer. I can't abandon this client. There's always a reason not to get sober, right?
Yeah. That one client was marching you around, right?
Yeah, that one client. I had one client left, you know, because I've spent more time doing blow and drinking than being a good lawyer. But that one client was my excuse not to get sober. Fortunately, I worked my way past that. But yeah, I think back on that and laugh.
Yeah, you think you just absolutely can't get the help you need, right? Because you're helping somebody
else.
That's
right. That's right. In any profession, there's always a reason not to get help. Mm-hmm.
And those excuses never, you know, getting the person to realize that an excuse never betters your position. You know what I mean? It's a way
Absolutely. That's especially difficult in the legal profession to get lawyers to that point of realizing that.
Right. And so those excuses are a way of bending, you know, bending facts or bending reality to explain something. But at the end of the day, you know, it doesn't bear their position. And I've used that line a lot with some of the attorneys I've worked with, like, you know, it just doesn't better your position. And finally, okay, you know, you are right about that. So, and it's just, it is interesting. And also I think working with attorneys, you have to, the careful use of language, you know what I mean? If you think about all the great verbal skills attorneys have, particularly litigators and those things, you have to really.
Very good verbal skills.
I have to be very clear, very clear and cogent with my communication and not, you know, not mince words or whatever, because you can get down a rabbit hole.
And one thing about the addicted lawyer that, you know, I like everything about it, of course, because it's my book, but it has stories. I mean, yeah, I'm giving myself a big thumbs up there.
Good for you.
Right.
But it has stories from people. You know, sometimes there are consequences. Okay, if you steal money from a client,
right,
which is not uncommon, where serious addiction is, and where addiction is involved with lawyers, it happens. The state bar is not going to look kindly on that, regardless if you go into recovery. They may help you go into recovery, okay, and move you along, but you're still probably going to lose your license.
Still going to pay the price.
Right. You're still going to pay the price. Recovery does not mean lack of accountability. Recovery does not mean lack of consequences. Recovery means being accountable and then redefining your life. My book has my book has stories from lawyers who have had their license suspended and come back and are now outstanding attorneys, successful attorneys, who have had their license suspended and gone on to do something else and who have been disbarred and redefined their lives and are very happy now. Whatever the consequences, whatever the accountability, you can move forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You can move forward, you know, or it's not the recovery, because that's a bigger word than the word treatment. You know what I mean? Well, I went into treatment. If I go into treatment, what kind of consequences can I face? Do you know what I mean? It's not necessarily, they're not thinking in a recovery mindset early on, you know, they're just thinking about the next move and what the gain is for that move.
Absolutely. I mean, lawyers tell me, well, I'm afraid of this, this, and this. Well, do you think that's going to get any better by not doing anything now and waiting, you know, and waiting till it blows up in your face? Then for sure this is going to happen, right? But this hasn't happened yet. So why not start now and let's try to ensure that it doesn't?
Yeah, hedge it off.
As common sense as that sounds, and I know having been there, when someone's right in the middle of it, it doesn't make sense. It's counterintuitive.
Yeah.
When you're right in the middle of it, what I knew was I have no consequences right now. So
or you're just willing to pay them. You're just willing to continue to pay them.
Well, yeah, or that. That's right. I looking back, my mindset is, well, that stuff hasn't happened to me. I'm fine right now.
Yeah, and I'm willing to pay the consequence. It's not going to stop me from what I'm doing.
That's right. So, you know, there's a different way of thinking when you're right in the middle of it. And that's and I know from being there that that's a tough mindset to overcome without help.
Mm-hmm. Needs lots of help, right? I liked what you said about having as many healthy people, sober coaches, therapists, as many people around you for when that moment happens. When you have
that is one of the most important things. Connections is one of the most important things in recovery. It takes me back to 2005. I was very lucky because when I try to explain people what happens in a suicidal state, and I think back when I became suicidal, it happened like that, where you go from just thinking about it to all of a sudden to action, where you're ready for action. And that is when having people around me at the right time, at the right moment was probably saved my life.
Yeah, life-saving, absolutely.
That's right, because a lot of people don't understand, if you're trying to explain it to them, how fast that happens, how fast the suicidal fog transitions to action. Robin Williams is an example I give all the time. When he tragically took his life, people talked about he had therapy and he had people around him. And I point out, look, you can have all the people in the world, but if someone is not there at that moment, that's how fast it happens. That's how impulsive it is. Then, you know, and there's sometimes, and that's where people slip through the cracks. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense. You used a really good word, impulsive. It's very impulsive.
That's right. And it's nobody's fault. People can't be there every second, but the more people that are around you, the better the odds are
that you're going to survive it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes total sense to me.
So it's about improving the odds of recovery, improving the odds of survival, and connections do that.
Some people don't have that connection. Maybe they don't have enough connection. Yeah.
They don't, and it's such a sad state of we are a disconnected society. We are a disconnected society, and we are disconnected from, you know, from the lower income areas right up to people of privilege.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And absolutely. I'm not sure, and it's a systemic issue, it's a societal issue, and I'm not sure what the answer is.
Well, we got about 4 minutes left of the show. I tell you, this time just goes by so quick, Brian.
It does. Just
fill it up, and it's just such a discussion just flows so well. But
there's a guy named Johann Hari who wrote a book called the New York Times bestseller called Chasing the Scream. I don't get along with him that well. I think he actually blocked me on Twitter, but he makes a wonderful point about connections and what a disconnected society we are, and how that disconnection starting at the most basic levels is contributing to present day problems with addiction. And I wish I knew how we could become more connected. We are becoming more disconnected with technology.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but it's so important to have people around you that care about you. You know what I mean? And there's a lot of people that live, you know, in isolation and get more and more isolated as the shame builds and the behavior. You know what I mean? The addiction.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So then there's
absolutely. I isolated myself. That was to me, rather than accepting my family's help in understanding that they love me and they were trying to save my life, it made more sense to me just to isolate to my circle of drug, you know, people using drugs.
Right. And then, of course, you know, the blame.
You know, and sit at home alone.
Or blame them, you know.
That's right, blame them. That's right. That is very common.
Yeah. So that limits the ability to connect. So, yeah, that's a shame, huh?
That's right. That's right. Connections are so important.
They are. Well, Brian, how can our listeners reach out to you, reach you, and just kind of go ahead and lay out your contact points for our listeners?
I am open to anyone who ever wants to email me with, you know, something they're going through, they need someone to talk to, whatever. My email is brian@addictedlawyer.com. My website is www.briancuban.com, and I hope you will check out my new book, The Addicted Lawyer, on amazon.com.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. You have been an incredible guest. We really appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule 2 weeks in a row to be on the Concierge Coaches Show. Thank you so much.
I appreciate the opportunity to come on, and feel free to have me on anytime. I enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Well, take care, Brian. We'll talk to you. We'll talk to you soon. Maybe we'll see you at Starbucks.
Sounds good. Thanks, folks. Take care.
Take care.
All right. Well, good. Man, just another great episode of our show today, Cindy. And man, just a lot of good information for our listeners. And I'm hoping when his book comes out, that others in the legal profession and others will be able to identify with what he's written and inspire them to get the help that they need, whatever form that may be, whether it be treatment or coaching or whatnot. So really glad to do that. So, all right. Well, you want to lay out your contact information?
Yes, I can be reached at directly by phone, 714-943-6206, or on my website at wisdomfoods.com. And appreciate everybody listening in today.
And, yep, I can be reached at www.conciergecoach.net. My Twitter is at Cameron Coaches. So, everybody, we will see y'all next week with another exciting episode of the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. See you then.
Thanks.
Have a good week.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Cindy DeFerdinand, only on LA Talk Radio.